You are listening to Tech Reads, interviews with emerging technology thought leaders. Our sponsor is Softech, the premier technology trade association that has been serving northern Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County since 1997. Our mission is to create Softech moments where people connect, explore ideas, and create new business opportunities. Learn more at softec.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Brian Schwartz from Softech. We're here for another exciting episode of Tech Reads, the podcast with bestsellers and storytellers. These are folks that are leaders in their industry, subject matter experts. Dr. Mary Lippert is no exception. We also have Bob DeMuschel, our president, joining us today. Bob, thanks for joining us. Anything you want to announce about Softech to the crew before we get started with Mary?
Just glad to be here. The efforts in Softech recently have been around, circled around the Idea Lab, which is trying to generate the ecosystem for entrepreneurship in the community. So that's kind of what's been possessing me recently.
All right.
I'm excited to hear the topic today.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Mary Lippert, I will let you introduce yourself. I've known Mary for many years. Actually, I think 2019, we actually first worked together on her book, Situational Mindsets, which she'll talk a little bit about. Leadership, I believe, is your third book, right? So we're going to talk about your third book and just published. But why don't you first just give a little bit of a background about yourself?
Okay, thank you. I have had the pleasure of working with organizations in my firm Enterprise Management now for 40 years. My background is actually a doctorate in business administration. I think it's called NEPO. My father and uncle were also in the field. My father was at George Washington University. My uncle actually did the very first leadership styles study in 1939. And so we've gone a long way after styles. And I really have found that leaders have trouble making sure change gets implemented. And they can start it a lot, but the question is, can it get implemented? So I've been focusing on that. And my new book is called Leadership, not Leadership, Leadership, because I use a story about a herd that is in a drought-ridden pasture and has to make a change. And I'm using sheep partially because there's actually a word called sheeples. And they combined sheep with people, thinking that that sheep will just follow you. And so all the leader has to do is, say, this is where we're gonna go and everybody will follow. And that just is not the case. Mm. They have done some recent research, and the number of failures for change efforts is still high. It's now 50%. It had been 70%. So we're getting better, but failed change really is very expensive. Resources, credibility, survivability of an organization. So we really need to do change better.
How would you define an organization going through change? Because it's not something they're perpetually in the midst of, right? Because that would be a very uncertain company to work with
for. I think you're right. If it's transformational change that we're not going through a lot, not every organization is constantly having a merger or doing an IPO kind of thing. Okay. But I really think that change is now become constant. I think that it is like death and taxes. It's going to be with us forever. Today or yesterday, we got some new tariffs. Things are moving so fast. Organizations that are highly successful, all they do is attract competition. And so even if you're a highly successful organization, you're still going to have to stay on your toes, looking for either new products, new markets, new partnerships, new geography of some type. So I think that the continual change still will be constant. I think some transitional change, but the transformational change is going to be sporadic.
So the old saying, you're either growing or dying, has never been more true, right?
I would agree, yes.
You're not staying still. And what would be some of the smallest versions of change that would necessitate taking a systematic approach? And we'll talk a little bit more in a bit about the framework that you talk about. But what are sort of the smallest kind of indicators? And then maybe on the high extreme, obviously it's mergers, major deals, but what would be the smallest indication?
Sometimes it's the layout of a plant, because you're changing who you're going to be next to. You may have to walk farther to get supplies, or the person that has to do an inspection is not going to be available. So some of those things are small. I actually had a situation where a client over the weekend replaced everybody's computers and reorganized their offices, and then they assigned them to new supervisors. And what was really interesting was there was resistance, and I got the opportunity to call people in without management and asked, what's the real problem? And they said, they changed who I had lunch with. So you never know, if I got a
How
new
it's going to impact
computer.
that person.
That was the impact. No, it was for every suit. Everyone in the meeting had a lateral meeting, and that was their major concern. Obviously, other people could care about their supervisor or whatever else, but the vocal piece was lunch hour. So
Incredible.
I think that sometimes change is vocal. I'll resist it. Why are we doing this? That's not a good idea, kind of thing. Change can also be very passive. It's the difference between being overt and covert. I would actually rather have somebody overt say to me, I don't like this, this is wrong, this will ruin blank, 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 than a person who feels that way but doesn't say it. And one of the signals I would look for is when I announce something, and if the room is quiet, but as soon as they leave, the hall is just booming with voices, which means that they are not asking questions. If people are adjusting to change and they don't have any questions, then we know something is of concern to them.
Yeah, that is the most dangerous, right? It's what they say behind your back, or like you said, you try to root out, because I worked for a company that they were always trying to find out sort of what was the source of the toxic, and it was usually the person who was the most covert, as you said, because their approach is not facing things fate head on, but rather kind of being more covert in how they're approaching things.
Actually, there's something in between. I once asked somebody, he says, I'm on the B team. I didn't know what the B team meant. So I asked, what's the B team? I'd be here when it starts. I'd be here when it ends. It will all go away. I'm just going to be passive about it. I won't object. I won't necessarily fight it, but I'm going to be passive. And that kind of non-engagement, if I could call it that, is also very dangerous to a successful change.
Bob, did you have a thought?
Well, yeah, I think that passive resistance is almost always the big problem. And we keep looking at the technology industry as an example, which is where we live. And quite frankly, the expression is that change will never be any slower than it is today, meaning
Right.
that as you step forward, it's getting faster, not slower. And the passive resistance stuff becomes a real bottleneck in the process. And how you deal with that is an interesting conversation.
Think there's one way that is highly effective, and that is just to let people go into a room and put on the flip charts all their concerns. Nobody's watching them. Nobody knew who spoke about it, but you could get all that information up. Again, it's making it anonymous, which makes it safe. And but yeah, I just find that that's a very simple way of surfacing a lot of information very quickly and with a sense of Trust if action is taken. If you do that and you don't listen to the input, trust will really crash and everybody will become more covert.
Yeah, I think about a couple of businesses here locally that have been here for a long, long time. And in the last year, a couple have like closed. And these are like staples to the community. And I asked myself, you know, what was my experience when I went to those businesses last? And it wasn't good. And I was like, okay, it was no surprise. They basically lasted another year or so because they had a legacy, right? Of people that came into town and they wanted to go to these two restaurants. If they had just like allowed anonymous feedback to be submitted very easily by their patrons, they would have known there was something wrong. Like there's a reason, there's probably consistent reasons why the experience has gone downhill. And in both cases, it wasn't the service, it was the food. Something had changed with the quality of the food that they were saving money. I mean, they basically cut out, it wasn't enough. The experience didn't make up for the quality of the food, which was not what it used to be. Or the prices had gotten kind of, they overcorrected from inflation maybe.
Yeah.
But it's just kind of asking the questions is, you know, what was your experience? We appreciate you that you've been coming here for all these years. If they don't want to close the doors, you need to be open to that feedback. So I think what you're saying, that anonymous opportunity for people to chime in is, and even with our organization, Bob, it's the idea of getting, asking people to submit, like even anonymously. So they're going to be hopefully more brutally honest, which we want. You know, why didn't you come? Or what was your experience of this event that we held? Or, you know.
Or we could be more specific. We could say, what should we start doing that we're not doing? What should we stop doing that we are doing? What we should do more of, what we should do less of. So you're going to get, if you ask those questions, you get more specific information rather than just something, you know, about your hours or your prices or something like that. I have seen an awful lot of organizational surveys that identify the problem, but they don't really identify or provide input into a solution. So asking those four questions, you can get a bit more detail and, you know, see if there is a common thread that you could act on.
I think that's great. You know, I one of the questions I had, but I don't think it really applies because of the situation we're in, but was basically, are there early indicators of change that is disrupting an organization? But maybe that is the start of it, where, you know, this organization, this company, the early indications that it's going to close. Like if we had a crystal ball today, a year from today, are there things that those organizations can start, that leaders in those organizations can start to tune into so they're not blindsided later?
Well, I think that one of the key issues is getting customer feedback, like we sort of talked about. But I also think that inattention to the skill development of the workforce, I have to say that I never had much training in certain areas. And as, let's just say, the organization moves to higher technology requirements, or they move to higher marketing focal points, or they move to a new geography, and I am now at a field office rather than the headquarters. I mean, all those things play a role. And I actually had a client which was moving offices, and they were building new buildings, but they took their people to the new location to show, hey, we have cleaners, we have you know, fast food places available. They helped acquaint. And it sort of reminds me of when we started the quality movement, because what they did was they actually brought people either to Japan, or they brought some Japanese people here to talk to them. So helping to reduce the uncertainty, the fear, the feeling that we're taking a wrong turn and it's just going to be a dead end, can do a great deal. And even if you don't want to bring somebody from overseas, again, sharing case studies where this has worked and showing the commonality between the successful case in our company, bringing customers in to talk about what they want, anything that can help people recognize why we really need to make the change. And also, I will just put a comment about focus on what I will call reflective listening. There's a lot of people that do active listening. And what active listening is, I'll be quiet, you can talk, and then I just summarize. There's nothing happens. In reflective listening, I listen, like I'm quiet, but I promise to think about it and come back with some good ideas. And we don't give ourselves the time to really integrate what I've heard and then be able to come up with something that would address it. So I would just say active listening as it is commonly used, not as how it was defined or taught to anything, but as it's commonly used is I will listen, summarize, and say, thank you very much, and just go on my way, and nothing changes. So I think that the people that ask for feedback have a responsibility to think about it and see how we can build bridges. And it's not going to be my way or your way, it's going to be a common way.
Do you think that there are people that are predisposed to handling or embracing change? It's a hiring personality, if you will. And my other question is, as we grow older, why is there more resistance to change than there was when we were younger?
I will say that as we grow older, we have more experience with failure of change. So we're more alert to the fact that a lot of the promise never materializes. And
disenchanted.
Yes.
Okay.
Great word. Thank you. Yeah, I would say disenchanted. And I would also just, suggest that there's a process where people pile on change after change. I had a client, they're doing an ERP, and they found some problems that, legacy data systems weren't coordinating. So that's why they're introducing it. Then they found a lot of faulty data and all that kind of stuff. And so they're off schedule. And so what did they decide to do? They decided that they should now also do an IPO. So you doing an ERP and an IPO at the same time, very different activities.
Too many acronyms.
Too many acronyms and again, inattention to the impact on the workforce.
Well, you could say right now that we're, as a country, undergoing an onslaught of changes after changes, which before we've even had time to digest one change, they're throwing another change. And it's just becoming now, I suppose it's, I sort of feel like we're at the breaking point for a lot of us where don't change this one part of my life because this is like my one stable rock. Everything else is so uncertain right now. And I mean, I come back sort of my mindfulness practice is like, at the end, none of it matters, right? But in the heat of the moment, well, and we all end up in the same place. It's just the question is, can we enjoy the ride, find ways to enjoy it. But I do think right now your work is more needed because the sensitivity, again, we're just so, I hate to say it, we're more fragile as a culture because we're dealing with, again, this sort of environment that we've never, I mean, even our parent, even anyone who's been around for 80 years is looking at this saying, what? This is never experienced. I mean, I don't know, Bob, you lived through the Vietnam era. He's a veteran. Do you feel like this is now a whole new level, or is it just that we're more aware and seeing things and it's a different perspective?
I think we're just closer to the pain, so we experience it better. I think that a lot of times, people talk about the different generations and all these types of things. And now Gen X is under the microscope because they're making that transition from student to workforce, which is a change in culture, not just a change in place that's going on. And that's no different than when I was growing up and, we were going from the school place to the workplace. And all of those dramas came through. The same thing with millennial. History repeats itself over and over and over, but every time it's whatever is the most painful, closest to you at this point. And it's one of the things that drives me nuts with like our media these days is that everything is breaking news. Well, it can't all be breaking news, okay? Some of this is just routine. Breaking news, the president landed his plane. Not news.
Right. Well, or even you could say, like, all of a sudden, why are there all these issues at airports and airlines, right? Is it actually worse? I think there's just a heightened sense these things have been happening. But now, as you said, Bob, any little anything that happens now is being like the microscope is on anything. And depending on what the event is, it seems like we're all on high alert. And I think you're right. And I blame these to a large extent, because never before were we just constantly pinged with the late breaking news. And not only that, but people's opinions of what's going on. Like, I feel like if everyone has a voice, then no one has a voice. And we're kind of in that point right now where everybody's got a microphone, but it's all starting to, I don't know, fall on deaf ears, because you can't all speak.
Well, the noise gets so loud that you can't hear it. I mean, this is the classic problem in marketing these days, is the market is so noisy that everybody's trying to raise their voice higher and higher and higher. Eventually, it fails. So you asked about a leading indicator for having problems. Success is the leading indicator for failure.
Let me also say that as more times I'm experiencing shock of change, what happens is I become uncomfortable. And discomfort means low trust. Trust is really comfort with someone else, that I know what will happen. I'm confident in what they will do. And personally, I am not able to predict very much of what's happening next. So trust in institutions as well as people have been impacted.
But all of this drama has gone on for as long as I can remember. It just, the groups have changed, the issues have changed, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, people don't adjust well to change. Some people do and some people don't. But, you know, you start dividing the population down, and, you know, 80% are the sheep and 20% aren't. And they're very different groups.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit more, Mary. The title of your book is Leadership. There's a subtitle as well, Executing Change Through Fable and Framework. Maybe just expand a little bit on that and what you really want people to get from this book.
My goal is to, the reason for the fable and stories, people like it. And I actually had a sheepdog as a child, so I like sheepdog. But what I was trying to do with a fable is to provide an overview of the entire change process. I think that change has too often been limited to vision. And there's a saying, vision without execution is a hallucination. And we've got a lot of people out there hallucinating. So the overall fable tells exactly how something gets done. And the next part of the book talks about the five levers for making change happen. And obviously, one of them is vision, but making sure that it's clear. I once had a client who said, I have my vision. And I said, okay, great. And he said, empower, free, and serve. Okay, I like every one of those words, but I didn't know what they meant. So I talked to his executives, they didn't know. The employees thought, okay, I'm gonna be empowered to do my job, there's gonna no micromanagement, I'm gonna be free, and I can serve the customers. And it wasn't that at all. He was gonna start operating 7 days a week instead of six. He was creating new distribution centers, he was changing his online services. I mean, he went for charisma and warm words rather than being specific about what the vision is. And the other real problem on vision is trying to do too much at one time. There's some wonderful, it's a wonderful case study about Alcoa being suffering. A new president comes in. His one thing is we're going to improve employee safety. And they did. but it also improved profitability, it improved retention, it improved everything. So finding something narrow where you can show that it's having impact, that it's something that people are clear about, it is an important first step. But the second step is making sure people have the skills to do the job. I was working with one organization, they wanted self-managed teams, so they pulled everybody together. Fine, it's a good idea. Never trained them on how to be a self-managed team. A self-managed team is different than a regular operational team. So you got to have the vision, and you have to have the skills, and then you need to have the incentives. And I think a lot of people know Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and the lower two are safety and physical comfort. And the other three are intangible. But most people, when they're doing change, only focus on the tangible. We're going to do this because otherwise we'll fail. The old burning oil platform kind of thing. And they're not looking or listening to what the intangibles are that people are going to be motivated for a longer period of time. I mean, if you give somebody a salary increase, if you give me a salary increase, I'd be happy. But after 6 months, I've already spent it. So the incentives have to be re-examined. And then the resources becomes a major point, because what resources were available to start may not be available when you need them. It's not just money and staff and facilities and tools. You know, it's access to resolve conflict. It's policies that will support what you're doing. A lot of people want teaming, but when it comes to performance appraisal, I'm going to evaluate it as an individual. So that conflict between policy and practice has to be addressed. And then we've already talked a bit about the need for action planning, a pilot, the ability to monitor the project and make adjustments in the critical path. A lot of people feel that once I announce a vision, I got to stick with it no matter what, because if I don't, it will look like I was wrong. So I won't change anything. And, you know, I forgot the number, but I think it's every 9 seconds when we're driving, we adjust the wheel. A major change is much more complicated than driving a car. So I'm looking at having the vision. And if we don't have that, we have confusion. If we don't develop the skills, what we'll see in the organizations are anxiety. If we don't have the incentives, then we will have some kind of hesitation, resistance. If we don't have the resources that people get, they want to do it, they know how to do it, and then we don't have the resources, then we have frustration. And then if we have the first vision, skills, incentives, resources, and don't have a plan, of course, nothing gets done. So I was trying to walk people through each one of those, looking at the questions you have to ask to make sure that you fully considered all the ramifications. Our world is so complicated that we can't just think of two or three variables. There are a lot more. So I'm trying to give people a tool to do the job themselves. Obviously, I'm happy to be a consultant, but I really want people to be able to think through a change effort and actually make it happen, because we're wasting a lot if we, you know, try one thing and then it dies down. It just seems to evaporate. And then another one gets started and people just start to say, okay, I'll sit this one. We'll see what happens if this one works. And that's too costly for an organization that is in a very fast evolving world.
Yeah, you don't want a bunch of B team players, like you said. That's interesting. And I actually am when a big organization, I mean, at least my one view is the B team players sometimes are the ones that outlast the A teams, where, you know, the change is just too much to handle and they're out of there. But if you just sort of waited it out, you know, there's a new manager, a new initiative, like it goes away. But if you looked at it as this was a pilot program, and if they don't announce it as a pilot program, but you know in your mind, okay, this is a pilot program, I'm going to wait and see, I'm going to support this initiative and get behind it, but knowing that it's everything's an experiment and failure is, you know, that's just part of the process. That's the stepping stones to success. I love Bob's reminds me often failure is really not even there's no such thing. You either succeed or you learn something. And it takes many learnings sometimes to reach that su to success. I mean, sometimes you kill two birds with a stone. Sometimes it takes two stones to kill a bird, right? It varies. But I do, if I had had that perspective, Mary, I probably would have stayed with IBM longer.
Well, but there, historically, I would say IBM was a little on the slow to change. And now we see, I think they've done a marvelous job of making adjustments. And so, it's interesting to see that I think those adjustments are needed much more rapidly because it is a thrive or fail situation for many organizations. And I will also say that, the people that leave because change doesn't happen usually are the more talented people who know they could get a job and work with a company that is making the changes necessary, that is, innovative or high cult performing culture or developing their people or making strategic alliances. Good people leave a little faster than the B team folks.
I think that's very revealing for sure. And an organization, again, their legacy or the amount of money in the bank will ride them for a long time, but eventually, the competition will eat their lunch. And you have to be in that environment. And I'm amazed at companies like Amazon where, they'll kill, or Google, they kill products that seem great, but at the same time, they don't mess around. Like if it's not hitting the double digit growth that they need, then they axe that project. And there's a website that talks about all the programs that Google's killed over the years. And it's mind-boggling to see just how
Well,
many things.
I think if you look at it, if you're succeeding more than 50% of the time, you're a coward. You're not taking any risk. I think it's really difficult when people look at it and say, I'm worried about success. The only time you can fail is if you stop. Okay? Until you stop, you're not failing, you're working on it. And I think it just takes a different mindset. It's like when large companies try to innovate, they can't innovate. It's culturally against their will. Their mantra, they're run by managers who are based on facts of how do I scale this? That's their thing, is scaling stuff up. Innovate, large businesses don't innovate. That's why they buy small ones.
Yes.
For billions of dollars these days.
Well, and those small ones are the fish food for the large ones. But the reality is, all of these innovations and stuff require breaking rules, and you need a layer at which those sins are forgiven and the product goes forward. Take a product like Uber. I mean, against the law in 18 different ways, all the licensing in all the cities and all the states absolutely prohibit that from existing, yet it was allowed. And now that it's part of the culture, it's now, it's now mainstream. Amazon was the same way, violated the hell out of rules regarding distribution of things. I'm going back to the Rockefeller days. These are antitrust rules that they violated left and right.
And
OpenAI violated copyright on a global scale. Airbnb, again, violating all the bed taxes in the whole world.
get banned. Entire cities have banned, tried to ban them, but now they're welcoming them back because they need more rooms. They need more people in their
Well,
city.
I just
Right,
add that in New York
but large
City.
business and small business innovation is the issue. I don't think a large business can innovate, but I get
In
yelled at a
New
lot for
York
that.
City, they have now requiring B&Bs to get a license. And because so many people were using it for an Airbnb, that places were not available for people to live. So it, you know, it there's a continual need to pay attention. I just will offer one question for somebody to ask, is who got promoted last and why? And if they got promoted by playing by the rules, that tells you a whole lot. And I could go into a lot of organizations and find out that it was somebody who golfed with somebody or somebody who was always a conflict resolver, never doing anything new. And so it's an interesting policy issue is what is your promotion plan? Is it tenure or is it actual achievement?
Yeah, that actually does say a lot. Where are you an organization that's willing to take the kind of risks where sometimes they're going to fail and you're going to piss some people off? But I think, Bob, that's a good perspective too to have just in what we're going through. Like, again, at the start, there was all this uproar about Uber, right? People were just beside themselves that they were doing what they were doing and they were violating all these rules. But now, how many of us depend on Uber, like are grateful for Uber, especially when you get older and you can't drive anywhere more like my parents? Like, thank God for Uber. But initially, there was all this resistance. So maybe we can just chill out that a lot of the changes that are happening in our country right now are going to be a little bit of shock and awe initially. And the media loves to build them up like that. But then we're going to look back and say, man, I can't imagine why we had this organization. My life is so much easier now. Like, there are things that hopefully we will see on the other end, but we have to keep this long view perspective that maybe I'm speaking for myself, but I think I've lost a little bit of being caught up in just the day to day of the chaos.
But I will also remind you that Uber continues to innovate. I mean, the fact they came up with Uber Teams. And, when I first started using Uber, I didn't,
Uber
get
Eats. Yep.
Uber Eats. I mean, it's
Okay, but just a
amazing.
second. Aren't
Okay.
those all incremental improvements over the base model?
Yes.
So it's not innovating. It's incremental change. It's lean manufacturing. It's the lean strategy of incremental improvement. Make the smallest decision you possibly can and continually move the needle.
Because
That's different than innovation.
they got a lot more to lose now, right? Or a lot more at stake, and
Oh, yeah.
they got to feed the pig. I mean, they have the what pays the bills, and their bread and butter. And I think at the like, all right, let's look at. I was realizing the other day that there's a business where their bread and butter is clearly dying on the vine, and they have to figure out something else because what's kept them in business is not going to keep them in business. What got them where they are today is not what's going to keep them there. So they need injections of innovators to come into that company and change makers.
But those are in complete conflict with the managers that run the scalable business. And so culturally, you have these two things. That's why I'm interested in this sheeple approach, is that you have that story all the time of you need the innovation because you can't survive without evolving, and you can't evolve because, hey, where's the case study to prove that works?
Well, I mean, that's the old story about FedEx, where he turned in the plan for FedEx for a grade and he got a C on it, supposedly. I'm not 100% sure it's true, but then he went ahead and implemented it, and obviously FedEx has been successful. I will also say that in small businesses and entrepreneurship, the entrepreneur who has become successful sometimes hates changing anything because they thought they found the formula. And particularly that happens when a second generation comes along and wants to change what mom or dad did. And mom and dad said, no, you can't do that. Stick to your knitting kind of thing. And so this constant awareness of a need to be creative, innovative, or even if it's incremental improvement, you got to do it. But there's so many things in your mind that says, don't change, what got us here.
Don't mess with the recipe or the secret sauce, unless it's a restaurant and there truly is something about that recipe that is the gold mine. I just went to a talk with the mill that she's called the Mac and Cheese Millionaire, and she started a company called or a restaurant called Homeroom in Oakland. But she said the one thing they were constantly innovating and changing and doing things, but the one thing that never changed was that recipe because that was their secret sauce, literally. And they had to follow that because that was the consistent experience that, like I was saying here with the restaurants locally, don't mess with the food. That's the one thing that got you there. I even think about like Taco Bell. My wife and I get the same thing every time because every time we've gone outside of their staples, we're disappointed. But don't mess with the bean burrito, because if you do, you're and they occasionally do that. They got rid of the green sauce. And there was this uproar from the public. What do you mean you're taking away the green sauce? This is why I come to Taco Bell anyway.
Yeah, but but if you don't turn over your menu in the restaurant business, you become stale and no longer a fun experience. And so there's two sides to that story. I mean, I lived in the restaurant business for 17 years. You have to churn your menu over and over. And do you have staples that stay there? Yes, that you do. And they are typically signature plates. But the bottom line is that if you're not changing the rest of it, if you're not giving something new to the people to try, the restaurants don't last very long if they don't do that. You got to churn 80% of your menu over a 5-year period, or you're toast.
Unless you're in and out, Bob.
Well,
They haven't changed their
In and
menu in
Out has
50 years. Right?
really.
Keep it simple. It's a double double, cheeseburger. This is the
And animal fry has been around how long?
Oh, okay. There are some, yes, there are some pivots that I
There
guess.
are secret menus at
Yes,
In-N-Out.
you're
There's
right.
all sorts of different things. When anytime you go to make a really big, broad statement, you're wrong the second you open your mouth.
Well, look at Starbucks. They're struggling right now, right? They're trying to condense their menu down to fewer things again and go back to what made them successful. But based on what we're talking about, I'm not sure that's a path to success for them because I don't know. I mean, let's actually just chat about that for a second, Mary. Have you ever seen that work? Kind of what Starbucks is doing, kind of going back to their basic, what got them successful
I
is.
think I've seen it in terms of a lot of people have what I'll call a strong customer base, and then they try to grow it, and then they're somehow shortchanging their customer base, and they return. But I think that I don't know any much about coffee business, but I think that a lot of what they're suffering from also is the fact that there aren't as many people in the offices, so they're not taking as they're not walking by. I think the foot traffic because people are hybrid or remote. I think they have some trouble there. I think inflation hurt them, but I think that COVID taught people that they could live without Starbucks too. I mean, I think a lot of things are going on.
Well, we've all bought really good coffee makers too, right? Keurig was probably a pretty big dent in there, and you get an espresso, and for half for a dollar a cup, you can get Starbucks quality coffee in your home, like you said, in the convenience. So yeah, there are a lot of other factors. So they're going to have to,
I
they got a
think
challenge.
inflation is also one of them, so yeah, and I think this just highlights for me the fact that we have to be much more alert to the various data sources that are available to us, and if we over rely on one, we're going to get I call it blindsided, but one of the studies I did a study of 6,000 leaders and found out the six different perspectives for priorities. And one of them is innovation, one of them is customer service, one of them is structure policy, and those kinds of internal operations. One was quality and ROI, one is culture and talent, and one is strategic thinking, alliances, partnerships, perspective. And if I just do one or two of those, it's really interesting. And what's interesting to me is that three of them want rapid change, and the other three want managed change. They want to do it slowly. So you have this conflict within an organization, even at an executive level, where people can disagree heartily about a plan that's being implemented.
Well, you want to mention anything about your other two books?
Well, one of my other books is Situational Mindsets, which goes into the six situational perspectives with the concept that a conflict comes when I'm arguing with somebody who has a different mindset. So I try to get people to see before I will say that you and I have a personal conflict and or you don't like me or something like that. I can start taking a look at what is it you're prioritizing, what is it I'm prioritizing, and where's the middle way? So the situational mindset identifies those. I think leadership style is very important. I think leadership skills or competency is important. I think character and traits important. But I don't think we've been paying enough attention to actually what are the proposals, what are the priorities, what are the mindsets that are in place. So if you and I have a conflict, it's good because you don't like people on the East Coast and you're on the West Coast. I mean, I could find all sorts of reasons how we're different, but I'm not looking at how can I solve it. I'm looking at putting a label on you that makes you feel more distant from me. And so if we could decide on what we can do for the organization together, we can resolve a lot of conflict. And there are some studies that suggest that organizations waste a lot of time on co internal conflict. So I'm trying to promote the idea of looking at what we're trying to achieve, our business mindset, rather than being personal about it or saying, that it's you have a character flaw or whatever else. I think we've over-personalized leadership. And so the Situational Mindsets book looks at that. And it's, to me, a very easy way because every one of those is right. I needed a vision. I need customers. I need structure and policy. I need quality. I need ROI. I need people and culture, and I need to be strategic. I mean, you're never wrong. And if I can work with somebody and we both see that we're right, then we could work together in a different way rather than saying, hey, you're West Coast people and I'm an East Coast person. I mean, I that will never get resolved.
And then Brilliant or Blunder, what's that one about?
That is the story about how people get blindsided because they have narrowly defined their options or their solutions. It's interesting to me to see how we've had fads. One time it was mergers, one time it was quality was a fad for a while. I'm not saying anything against quality, it's great. It's just, it can't be the only thing you're looking at. And when we over-rely on one solution, we're going to be less successful than we could.
It's the old adage of if you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right?
Exactly. And if somebody else had a hammer and nail and it worked for, I'm going to say the word IBM, it must work for my small businesses. Although IBM is not a small business. Has a different talent pool, a lot of other things. And I just can't take something that one large company did and then think I could transport it to mine. Replication is attractive, but it's not likely to be successful.
Okay.
Right. I think conflict in balance is actually good. I don't like to see teams of people that get along with each other. I like to see conflict. And I don't mean going over and becoming personal conflict. I'm talking about professional conflict because whether you're a maker, a marketer, or a manager, you're coming at the problem from a totally different perspective. And that's what makes the team strong. So
I would call
I
that
don't find
interesting.
harmony to be something I like very much most of the time.
I think you're right, but I would call it, I want divergent thinking. I'm
Yeah,
very
I
concerned
could buy
when it
that.
becomes groupthink.
Yeah, because nothing, no, I've never seen any indicator that groups are smarter than people.
Okay.
I mean, the herd has some safety and some places for everybody and all that good kind of stuff, but it's not particularly smart.
No.
Those are the sheeple you're talking about, right?
Those are the sheeples.
But if somebody introduces an idea to the sheeple, my argument would be the sheeple could see something that is a value and will follow what's a value, whether it needs a pilot study first, whether it needs,
We'll get on
skill training.
board.
Yeah, I mean, in the fable, the sheep had to learn how to swim distances. I mean, sheep don't like to get wet. Their wool gets heavy. They can drown. But if we take it, in sequence, we could make it happen. But you're right. If a leader introduces something and there's no one to support him, and we haven't tried it before, and there isn't a unit or division that's willing to give it a shot, it's a little harder to sell. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be sold. It just may be harder to sell. I do think that people spend a lot of time on change, on the vision, and they allocate time to the vision, and they don't really allocate enough time to execution. And frequently in technology, what I've found is when time gets squeezed, quality testing gets shortened, sometimes too much.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Lippitt, if people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to find out about more about you and the books you've written and the programs you offer?
Well, you could contact me on LinkedIn at Mary Lippitt, or you can go to Amazon where it has my books, or you can contact me at mlippitt@enterprisemgt.com. Love to hear from you.
And yes, if you Google enterprise management, I think your website's the first thing that pops up. So that's it's your consulting firm. And I didn't know about your legacy of change of leadership consultants and change makers. Like, it's in your DNA. So I totally get, and I was very impressed with that assessment that you had given me many years ago, which is tied to situational mindsets, like a very robust leadership. I don't know, it's not really a personality
No.
study, but it reveals a lot about your tendencies and
Yeah, and it's based on one project. It's not based on you as a person. It's looking at one project and what your priorities were for that and seeing if you're overlooking some questions that you should collect some data on.
And that would be the last thing I would say, because I look at a lot of books in the line of work I'm in, and I really appreciated the questions, the depth of questions that you had offered in the second part of the book, because those turn into checklists. It's very easy to take a list of questions and just like, okay, have I asked all these questions? And I think that a lot of times we jump to the end and forget a few steps, and we wonder why we get ourselves. And I've been struggling with, because with AI and looking back at just my history, like I seem to be repeating the same things every year. It's like, why am I keep doing the same things and struggling with the same problems? But oftentimes, I can find it out. I'm not asking the right questions, or I'm asking the same questions. And I think hiring a consultant, a coach, somebody with a different perspective can pay huge dividends. I mean, Bob was my mentor for quite a while, and he really helped me retool my business
That's
and in a
wonderful.
different way, because he comes in with a totally different perspective. Like, it's important to sort of gather these inputs and be open to changing ourselves so that we can be of more benefit to others.
I agree completely. Yes.
Cool. And Bob, anything else
Just
before?
value the divergent thinking, please.
No.
Say that again, Mary.
Just please value divergent thinking.
Ah, yes. Everyone's got a right to their own opinion. And if you were in their shoes, you would have the same opinion. So our experiences shape who we are and how we see the world. And I think that in the midst of all of this right now, we have to really come together and respect each other and honor the divergent thinking, because ultimately that moves us forward as a culture and as a planet. So thank you very much for your time today, everyone. And next month, Bob, you'll like this, and I'll get you her book in advance, but we are going to have Erin Wade on. She's the Mac and Cheese Millionaire. I met her this week here in San Luis Obispo, and she's got quite a story, and she comes from the restaurant business. So I'll get you a copy of her
Cool.
book.
That would be great.
All right,
Well,
you
thank you
guys.
very much. I've enjoyed this opportunity to chat with you.
Thank you for listening to Tech Reads, sponsored by Softech. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and share it with your colleagues. If you have comments, questions, or want to suggest an author for a future episode, visit Softech at softec.org and click on the Tech Reads link.